So welcome everyone to this latest episode of the Depot podcast. I'm Naomi Petropoulos and I'm your host today. In this podcast, I'll be speaking with Amber, Pete and Rebecca about oral history, if we love it or hate it, the use of oral history in our work, as well as how our practice has changed since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. So I'd just like to start off with some brief introductions, and I'm going to hand over to the panel here. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you're working, and what you're currently working on? And if we could start with Amber, is that all right?
Yeah, no bother. So yeah, hi everyone, my name's Amber. I'm a second year PhD student at the University of St Andrews in Fife in Scotland, working in the Department of History, and I'm studying ex-mining communities in Fife after the miner strike of 1984 to 1985, and I'm looking, I use oral histories to collect the experiences of different communities that we maybe wouldn't normally consider in ex-mining communities, so like the local LGBTQ plus society, the local migrants organisation, and other different community organisations as well. So looking forward to our chat.
Pete, do you
want to
go next?
Yeah, I'm Pete Hodson. I work as a postdoc researcher at Trinity College Dublin. The project looks at the gendered and political implications of deindustrialisation using two Northern Irish case studies, one being Galahad's Tobacco in Ballymena, and the other being the dairy textiles trade. And before that, I was a PhD student under Sean O'Connell's supervision at Queen's, was there between 2015 and 2019. And I've used oral history pretty much on a constant basis for the last 7 years. It's a great research methodology. I'm looking forward to today's chat.
Rebecca, what about yourself?
Hi, yes, I'm Rebecca Chatelier, and I'm a second year PhD student at the University of Strathclyde in the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences. I'm under supervision by Arthur McIver and Mark Ellis, and my project focuses on single industry towns. I'm doing a transatlantic study, a comparative study between a very small town in Scotland called Stanley and another in the United States called Remerton in Georgia. And both of them were created around the cotton industry, by around single cotton mills. So I'm looking at the deindustrialization of the textile industry and its effect on community, family, but more specifically women. And I'm using oral history methodology to help inform on the project and how it has affected people.
Very cool. I'll just jump in as well with a few bits of information on my project. There's actually a wee bit of crossover between myself and Pete. Currently, obviously, I'm Naomi Petropoulos at Queen's University Belfast under the supervision of Professor Sean O'Connell as well. And I'm part of the History, Anthropology, Politics and Philosophy School. So it's a good broad range of people that I can kind of work with. At the minute, I'm actually looking at the shirt making industry in Derry City, in particular looking at women, their role in just basically their general life, you know, how they got into the shirt factories, what life was like for them and what they went on to do afterwards. So really oral history is really the real centre of my project. And it's something that I've both embraced and grappled with over the last year. So I think we'll probably get into that in our conversation. And I'm just looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Just to kind of start us off, just with a very broad and general question. Do you enjoy using oral history? Love it, hate it? What do you think?
Personally, I love it. It's been a way of accessing working class voices in history in a way that's not possible, I don't think, to the same extent using archival sources. First used it in 2013 to look at the Belfast Dockland area, which has been hitherto neglected in academic studies. And we just tapped a really rich vein of oral history with all these working class narrators reflected on the experiences of living and working in the community. And I just saw its value from that point onwards. And I've used it in every single project since that point, you know, BA thesis, master's thesis, PhD, two postdocs, and it's served me well. It's a very rewarding way of doing history, I think.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I even though I'm only a second year PhD student, I actually tailored my PhD around the methodology of oral history. That's what caught my attention to begin with, was the methodology itself. And then I went from there and found a department or a university and a supervisor who could help me achieve working a project around oral history. So I love rhetoric. I've grown up around rhetoric, and I think it's extremely important. And I find that the use of oral history allows people who otherwise don't have a voice to promote their version or their experience of historical perspectives.
Yeah, I would just have to absolutely agree with what's already been said about, I love oral history. I love the sort of the radical potential of it to sort of undermine claims to like that of any type of hegemonic knowledge. And I do also have to be honest in that I haven't done much oral history yet. I do have lots of plans to. COVID has put a lot of delays on my plans to conduct my interviews for my PhD research. But I got to sort of dabble a little bit pre-COVID in some sort of like community organisations, not linked to my research, but just things I was doing in my spare time. And it's a great experience. And it produces some really, really important dialogues, I think, too. I love it, and hopefully we'll get to do more of it too.
It's going to sound like we're all drinking the Kool-Aid as soon as I love it as well. I love that phrase that you use there as well, Amber, you know, that idea of this radical potential, because it is wild at times. It's you can end up in a 30-minute conversation where every single thing is very structured and here's every single question answered, and you could also end in a 3.5-hour interview where you've talked about everything as well as what you're looking for. So it is, it's kind of it is unpredictable. But similarly, like I feel a bit of a great pretender here. I came into oral history very, very late. I had done a master's in public history at Queen's, and it was just by chance Sean O'Connell had a conversation, had a session about it, and I was like, you know, it really sort of opened up, like, oh yeah, actually we could, I could use that. And another thing about my project and about Derry in general is a lot of the records are either missing or incomplete. There's not been a lot like written. So oral history kind of opens up that potential to like let Derry people almost write the book themselves, I suppose, in a way. But yeah, similarly to you, Amber, as well, like COVID has just, we really can't have a conversation about oral history without talking about COVID these days, because even to this day, it's affecting my project as a whole, not just sort of, the actual oral history part of it itself. Are you finding the same? Is it just like, has it put a stop maybe to your work, or he's trying to plod on?
Yes, simply yes. I got my ethics approval completed within the first 3 months of starting my PhD. So I've been approved to go on with my project since about December of 2020. And since that point, I've only done maybe 3 oral history interviews, because with COVID, the only outlet to do these interviews is over Zoom or is over online. And when you're working with an older population, it's just not an accessible format for them. And because they're older, they're more vulnerable, and there's no way the university, in fact, the university had a policy that we could not do in-person interviews. Not to mention that over Zoom, you can get a little bit of people's facial expressions and a little bit of their communication, but you're not going to get that same expressiveness that you're going to get in person. interviews. So it has put a kibosh on getting very far, and it has definitely slowed down the momentum of my project. And I started getting in touch with potential participants back in May, hoping that with things opening back up, I'd be able to. And then I haven't been able to speak to them because I've been told to be put on hold. So that momentum, and now I have to reintroduce myself and get them back on board, and then go over the COVID protocols as well of interviewing in person, if they're willing to still interview in person now that I've got approval from the university to do so. So it has created a lot of complications, and unfortunately my supervisors have been doing the hint, you could always find other methodologies to inform as well, just in case. And like I said, this is the route I want to go. I don't want to find the other methodologies. So COVID has thrown a wrench or a spanner, as they like to say in the UK, in the works.
I've been in a really similar situation, Rebecca, where had sort of planned overall to start the oral history interviews at the start of this academic year in September. But I was sort of, with COVID, I was sort of given a bit of a choice where I could go and conduct these interviews virtually if I could get people to agree to take part in them in this way. But I interview, or I hope to interview, community groups. And so a big part of what I want to, it's similar to you with the age thing, Rebecca, with me, it's what I want is a group of people together, and I want to see how those different, how people bounce off each other, how the being in, and I'd like to ideally go to their community centre as well to be in their space, to see, you know, what type of dialogues and texts that us all being in that room together will produce. So I mean, I feel very fortunate in a sense to be given the choice at all, because I'm early on enough in my PhD to have the choice. But I could sort of go ahead and go for the virtual interviews, or I'll do what I've been doing, which is just sort of holding off to see, actually, provided I can get them done by the end of this academic year, I'm going to try and see if I can get them done in person. Which will hopefully happen in the next few months. In the meantime, what I've been doing is focusing a lot of my research on archived oral history interviews, which is very interesting. So interviews which were took place and were archived, which took place in the 1990s, which has been very interesting, because I can then sort of look at how things, like, cause that's the period that I study. So rather than looking at what the interviewee had to say about, you know, the 1920s or the 1930s, looking at how sort of consciousness and sort of the place of local history operates in the discourse and the dialogues created between the interviewee and interviewee. So that's been very interesting. So there have been some pros, I guess, to the... It's not all been doom and gloom from COVID, I guess, but hopefully things can move on soon.
It's an interesting thing as well that, like, both of you have kind of touched upon it, this ever-changing scenario. And it's something that's really kind of, you know, obviously there's legal implications and things like that. And it's something that I kind of want to insert into the conversation, Pete, because you're, as we call here down south, you're based in a Republic of Ireland institution. So your laws, even in general, with regards to COVID, are completely different to ours. Mm-hmm. So I'm intrigued about, and equally, Rebecca and Amber, you are both in Scotland, so your laws are different to mine in Northern Ireland. And, you know, really with Queen's at the minute, they're kind of in that limbo stage where we might think things might get better but at the same time, they're still at risk. So maybe just stick to online. You know, there's no sort of official stance like you've had, Rebecca, where it's like, oh, go face to face. So I'd be intrigued, Pete, about your experience in the different jurisdictions.
Well, I'll speak to me first, postdoc first. I was in McGee College in Derry until, August of this year. So as the pandemic hit in March 2020 even, I was interviewing right up to the 10th of March in people's homes in the Bogside and in Shantallow and the Fountain, up until basically 10 days before the pandemic lockdown started, the first one. So it was a complete shock to the system, for everyone. It was unexpected. I just left people alone for a few weeks. I had a big bank of people that I was going to talk to in person. So I just thought, well, I'll let people get through the pandemic the best they can the first few weeks. And then I started making sort of phone calls to them. You know, are you up for a telephone conversation or an internet conversation? And I concur with a lot of people were over the age of 75 and perhaps didn't have access to the internet or good quality internet at least. So I had to sort of come up with a very last minute method of capturing telephone conversations on Skype, which is very, very clunky. But it worked in the end, minus a few tech difficulties with BT. But so that was how I got around it. So from about May onwards until September 2020, I did about 15 remote interviews with people in Derry, which was it lacked a certain something. I can't quite put my finger on it. There's not being in a room with someone drinking tea and eating the biscuits is a very different situation to a Skype call. And I think both parties missed it. Although I had people that were saying to me that, you know, I'm glad you rang because the only person I spoke to today is you, sort of thing. You know, with that complete lockdown the first 2 or 3 months, it was a period of intense isolation for particularly older people. So I think the opportunity to be distracted by something and reflect on the past and have a conversation with someone over an hour and a half, 2 hours was a welcome thing for a lot of people. But currently I haven't interviewed anyone for my current project. And it's weird, you know, being based in Dublin technically, but the research is Northern Irish orientated. So I've got these cross-border things to negotiate. And of course, GDPR is still in force in its European form in the Republic of Ireland, and it isn't in Northern Ireland. So I've had to insert various legal clauses into consent forms to make sure I'm all okay and above board. But hopefully I'll not get caught out. It'll go smoothly.
Liz, it's added that extra layer of, like, not only are you sort of thinking about, you know, all the things that we've all been trained in, you know, obviously the concept do no harm, you know, that in general has taken on a completely different meaning. And especially like when infections are high in the community that you're working in, you know, it's kind of, it's not just do no harm to the people that you would potentially be visiting, but it's do no harm to yourself as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that risk versus reward. It's a very interesting thing what you said there, Pete, as well, about the fact that for you it kind of lacked a certain something. Was it were you already in contact with the people face to face before you then switched, did you say?
Yeah, luckily I'd already made me contact in sort of the winter of 2019-20 before the pandemic hit. So I was fairly active in the community centre, the Gas Yard Centre in the Bogside, and the Newgate Centre in the Fountain, sort of the big community areas. So I'd already made me contacts, and I was yet to meet them in person, sort of thing. So luckily in that respect, I had phone numbers and names and email addresses that I could go from. But it was just very disorientating. I'd never ever conducted an interview over the internet or the telephone prior to May of 2020, and it's a very steep learning curve. The tech was breaking down frequently, didn't know what I was doing, but luckily people were very generous and let me mess around for a few minutes before the interview started and make sure it was all okay. But I do miss it. Being in the house all day long interviewing people over Zoom doesn't have the same effects on either party, I don't think, compared to a face-to-face chat in a cafe in Derry or Belfast or wherever it is, or someone's home even. It's very different.
I find that really interesting because I haven't done face-to-face, like traditional face-to-face oral history ever. The only face-to-face interview that I did was with my own grandmother, who, you know, I was taking shopping out to anyway, because she was part of our bubble. So that's, for me, that's intriguing because I've found the online stuff quite rewarding, in the sense of something that you've touched upon there, you know, that whole idea of like, oh, you're the first person that I've seen today. Or, you know, there was one person who had said to me, you're the first person that I've seen in a week and a half at one point. And it's simultaneously heartbreaking but heartwarming at the same time, because it kind of, it highlighted for me the old, I similarly work with, you know, older people. You're talking about, you know, people who are at least 70, although it's not sort of restricted to that, but it's just the way it's panned out. And for them, the amount of them on Facebook is amazing. It's absolutely unreal. You know, it's one of those things where I think, certainly what I have found with the shirt factory workers that I'm working with, their embracing of technology was sped up by COVID. And as a result of it, it was like, oh, you want to do an interview? No, don't be ringing me. Call me through Facebook Messenger, or I'll get, you know, my daughter can set me up on Zoom. I'll get you a Zoom conversation. A lot of the times you end up looking at forehead and above, you know, if they're using their phone or something. But, you know, there's enough in the moving of up and down that you can kind of pick up what they're saying. So I find it quite rewarding, but I recognize at the same time that it's very foreign for people who have done oral history before, whereas this is almost my normal. I don't know how the rest of you feel, because I know, Amber, you're quite early on in your oral history journey as well. And like Rebecca, have you done many face-to-face oral history interviews before COVID?
I wouldn't say I've done any sort of official face-to-face oral history interviews before COVID as part of a project. But just based on some of my own life experience and my own conversations I've had with people, I've done things that are very similar, whether it was part of a project or whether there were consent forms or whatnot done. And I do find that there is a difference in openness from if you are sitting in someone's sitting room having, you know, tea and cake to being online. There's a lot of an overlap. There's a lot of communication lost, but I do appreciate the ability to be online, the ability to have that access. And even though I've been given the go ahead to continue my project in person, there were lots of caveats that were put on that. So I'm still offering the opportunity to be on Zoom or on a phone call if that's what they want. I still have certain parameters to consider if I am going to go in person to interview someone, because legally we cannot ask them to confirm that they're vaccinated or confirm that they've taken a lateral flow or anything. So there are risks to myself and someone else, because no matter if I'm being careful, I don't know if the participant is being careful, and I'm not allowed legally to ask if they're being careful. So Zoom, I think, still, or phone calls, audio, still provides an avenue, but there is a, I think, a comfortability factor that you lose over Zoom when you have that distance of person, that distance of place, than if you are in someone's home or in a cafe and natural conversation occurs, especially with the break in microphone, the way Zoom likes to cut one person off or another if you simply laugh or say uh-huh. But there are benefits to it. It helps with transcribing. It helps with having that backup audio file. And so there are benefits, and there are also backsides to it.
Yeah, I would completely agree, Rebecca. I'm in a very similar position where the interviews that I'd done before were part of just sort of like community local oral history project type thing, very informal. I think what I only did two or three, and I think one of them I couldn't even get a hold of a recorder, so like I just took some notes, you know, very relaxed, but a completely different experience. I imagine too, I've not conducted any virtual oral history interviews, but I've been talking to a lot of people over various virtual platforms, and it's just a very it's a very different experience. Something which I found was very specific to in-person interviewing when I did do it was that you all of you in the room, you sort of pivot around the formal thing which is to happen, which is I'm going to come in, and then quite often I would have somebody else from my community organisation would come with the camera to record. And we will pivot around this formal thing that is to happen. But around all of that was quite often when we weren't recording, was quite often when a lot of really interesting dialogue came out, which I possibly didn't have recorded. But, you know, I could say, would it be okay if I took a few notes and included this in the little thing that I'm writing about this? And they would say, of course. So it's just a completely different, possibly similar to what you guys were saying, where there are pros and cons, but it's just a very different setup, you know, completely. I want to say incomparable, because you can only operate within, you've only got that recorded bit, if that makes sense. You've not got everything around it. But yeah.
If I may just add as well, one thing that occurs to me is there's very little room for silence when you're on a phone or if you're online. And there's a lot of communication that happens in that silence, but you just don't get it over a phone call or over Zoom, because there's that pressure of no one's speaking. Are you still there? Is that okay? You know, there's that pressure to fill that space. Whereas if you're sitting with someone in person, that silence is allowed. So that is a form of communication that is missing.
Particular problem for telephone interviews, I suppose, really, isn't that idea of you always want to fill the gap, and it's you're fighting your natural instincts to go, yeah, that's right. Or, you know, because you don't want to cut across them, you want to get the best of their thoughts. And I think that's what kind of put off a lot of the participants that I had and have in my study. Like, unanimously, they all said, do not be ringing me. I don't want to do this over the phone. Some I had met in person before at a previous thing that they had done. They had actually done a podcast about their time, and that's how I kind of met them. I was an observer just at the very early stages of forming my project. So I was able to meet them and they knew me. But then there was other people that I just put a general call out on Facebook. And there were people from Canada, all over the place. Some were based in England, Scotland, further afield. And they were just like, yeah, absolutely. I'll ring you through Messenger. Is that all right? We'll talk that way. You know, there was never even a discussion of a telephone conversation. It was almost like a given, you know, that's what they wanted to do. And maybe that was what they were comfortable with. But I definitely found that very interesting, because as soon as COVID hit, panic stations hit for me, I'll be honest. I was like, I don't know how this is going to work. You know, that you're not going to get away a lot of people, older generations online. How's it going to work on the telephone equipment? All these different considerations that were, yes, sort of there in a face-to-face interview, all of a sudden became heightened for me. And, you know, like I say, my project, there was a month of panicking and looking at technology and trying to find, you know, all these different solutions and what will work best. And then I end up falling back on something as simple as Facebook Messenger and a screen recorder. And it did the job. And am I alone in that? Am I the lone worrier, panicker, or were yous the same?
I possibly should have been more on your kind of wavelength, Naomi. I naively assumed that by the time it came to me conducting my field research that, you know, maybe we wouldn't necessarily be through it, but, you know, oh, things like community hubs and whatnot will all be set back up, which was very, very naive of me. But I had a very, very similar, experience to recruitment, actually, where I think I would normally have relied on going in person to like little group community open days, meetings, or into their centres, you know, coffee mornings and things like that. And it was Facebook, which I found is used most predominantly, especially by older members, and community organisations more generally. And that out of all of the platforms that we've all sort of adapted to or learned to use for the first time, good old faithful Facebook has been the most fruitful for me. So I don't know about you guys. We've had similar experiences.
I was expecting to find more Facebook groups, but I think because my study is focused on extremely small towns of, we're talking, they way less than 10,000 residents of these towns. And yes, a lot of them have moved on, but a lot of their families are still around. My recruitment does still depend on finding gatekeepers and finding access points to these people. When I was looking at what community to study, I already had one because my family is from Remerton or Valdosta, Georgia. So I know that I had the gatekeepers there just through family access. But when I was looking for my Scottish side of the study, one place that became prominent was only prominent because it had a Facebook group. I ended up not going with that one. But yes, it was extremely attractive in that form, but it just didn't fit the study in other ways. So for my Stanley side of the study, I am relying very heavily on the Stanley Development Trust to help me get in touch with people who might be potential participants. And Naomi, I would like to ask a question, but I want Pete to be able to come in. So I'll save my question for a minute.
I think I'm being a bit of a Luddite really with Facebook because I am members of sort of ex-workers reminiscence groups, particularly in County Durham coal mining communities. But I never chose to recruit through that means. I'm not quite sure why. I always prefer going into a place in person, sort of walking into a working men's club or a community centre and sounding people out that way as opposed to going through Facebook. And perhaps it's just me being very old-fashioned, but that's just the way I've worked. And I perhaps, given the changes in the last 18 months, I'll have to change that viewpoint because I think the days of that are perhaps over and you need to create more virtual contact initially to reassure people about the project and your aims. So need to get yourself moving.
So if it's okay, I guess I can jump in with my question. And it's more sort of a theory and practice or psychology question that I'm rather intrigued about, since we have moved so many of our interviews online to Messenger or Zoom, where in in-person or phone conversation interviews, you don't see yourself. But over Zoom and Facebook Messenger, you do see yourself. And yes, I acknowledge that there's the ability to turn your camera off where you don't see yourself, but most people don't choose to do that. And do you think it changes the response that you're getting from people, that the natural responses, because it creates more of this self-consciousness where people are self-aware with them staring at themselves? We don't speak to other people in conversation looking at a mirror, and now we do.
That is a good point, actually. And it's something I found myself reflecting on, because in the initial couple of interviews that I had done through Zoom, obviously you can see yourself, and I found myself being exhausted. And I know that sounds ever so dramatic, but you know, it's that kind of feeling that you are naturally, we self-regulate anyway. Like when we're having conversations, if we were having conversations with participants face to face, we would kind of obviously try, you know, keep a neutral stance or whatever as much as that's possible, just to try and allow them to tease out these ideas. But all of a sudden, like naturally, I'm the kind of person that if I'm thinking something, it's on my face. Like my face is the loudest part of me, which is like probably a problem. But I became very aware of, I was looking at myself, and if they said something that was particularly like, that's very different to the way that I think, or very different to our way of thinking now, I found myself shooting myself a look, first of all, on screen and saying, right, face, shut up. So it was kind of, I think that's why I was so tired, because there was the ordinary self-regulation that we do on top of then seeing myself and realizing that it's their story and my reaction to their story could have that effect. So it was almost like interviewing myself and them at the same time. I don't know if that's maybe an overdramatic way of putting it, but certainly a lot of, I didn't really get that from the participants. I didn't really feel that they were looking at themselves. Maybe one or two made a comment of, oh, I did my hair for this, or, you know, something like that, because they were like, I'm going to be on screen. Even after me explaining, I'm using the audio. It's just the fact that I can see you, you know, don't worry about it. I'm not going to be like plastering this on this, the town centre, you know, and saying, look at this person, she's done her hair for this interview. So I didn't really get that from the participants, but certainly from my own perspective and my own practice, I was very, very aware. And I think it made it harder than it maybe should be if it was face to face. No, sorry, it was a bit of a rant there, a bit of a train of thought, but I don't know if you were thinking the same or what your experience is.
Yeah, I don't think it was a rant at all. I thought it was a really good point. It made me think of something that's going to sound very pretentious, but bear with me. But I think that possibly having to deal with these sort of new ways of communicating, it possibly brings into perspective how the media that we use to communicate, any media, is going to have some sort of determining role in the type of text that's produced. So if I'm to, you know, I think that possibly, like, say, phone is so integrated into how we communicate, but we don't think of the self-regulating that we do when we pick up the phone to speak to someone, like, you know, we put on our best phone voice, but I mean, I do it subconsciously. Whereas I would completely agree when we're doing this new thing where, as you say, Naomi, you're talking to someone whilst essentially looking in a mirror, you're very heightened to how that's impacting the type of dialogue or you know, visual and kind of verbal as well, the type of dialogue that that's producing. So I feel like, as with quite a few things, the pandemic's kind of brought into kind of perspective or into full view the absurdity, or if you like, of quite a lot of things that we do day to day, and just like how we talk to each other, how we move about in bits and pieces. So I thought it was a really, really good point. Yeah. I kind of want your participant who had done her hair, I'd like to broadcast it everywhere for her sake. That's so sweet.
Pete, what's been your experience of it?
Say again, sorry, Naomi.
Have you haven't done that? Have you done any like Zoom interviews?
I've not actually. No, it's all been Skype and telephone. I just kind of chanced upon it really, because the tech was such in a stage of infancy at this point. So I was interviewing for a short period between May and September of 2020. And I was using a very old laptop that I didn't quite have faith in to conduct a stable Zoom or Skype video interview. So I just thought the telephone was the natural choice. And some people that I were interviewing didn't actually have internet access in the first place. So I just ran with this method, thinking it was the perfect one, and it probably wasn't in retrospect. But yeah, certainly I think the telephone took some pressure off in terms of silences. I don't know, I found it more easy to deal with silences on the telephone than I was on the video. But I also missed the non-verbal cues, you know, people, you know, raising their eyebrows or, you know, shaking their head or whatever it was. You do miss that. You do miss an essential quality of oral history, which is the non-verbal element, which again is very hard to capture in a transcript too, unless you go to real, you know, forensic metadata methods. But yeah, it was, I wouldn't choose to do it again, put it that way. I would, at this point in time, for my new project, I would choose to do, if I can't do it in person, I'd choose Zoom or Skype video interviews rather than the telephone.
Rebecca, what's been your experience? Because that was like a brilliant thought, a brilliant question as well. Have you found that psychological impact on yourself or your participants or any of the work that you've done even?
I definitely find the psychological impact on myself, which is probably why I came up with the idea that this is probably affecting my participants as well. Because I do self-regulate and I have the same facial issues and it has gotten me in trouble. Apparently I scream at people with my face. If they make me not happy. I won't say it, but I guess my face says it all. And I've been told that by multiple people. So I do find it extremely diverting to have my face in front of me. And it's helpful for me, so I'm not screaming at them. But at the same time, I'm not giving that person who I'm in conversation with a genuine response either, which is going to change the way that they continue their story or respond to the next question. And if I'm doing it, my assumption is that they're having the same experience. And the only interview that I can draw from that I feel like I have some insight on is I did an interview with a family member where some of the questions I asked were to pull out stories that I had heard previously. And these stories I heard previously were in a very informal setting, in her living room, late at night, looking through photograph books, and they just, between herself and myself and another family member, they just spontaneously happened, and they were flowing, and it was just great conversation. And I remember thinking at that time, oh, I wish I had a recorder, but I didn't. And so I was trying to sort of capture a little bit of that when she did agree to be interviewed. And I was unable to, because she was extremely conscious of the fact that she was being interviewed, that she was being recorded. In fact, at one point, she drew attention to it. There was one story in particular where she began the story and then stopped and said, "Are you sure you want me to tell this? Are you sure you want this recorded?" And I was like, "Absolutely. Please continue." So that's the only experience so far that I have a direct comparison between that comfortability in the home and with familiars, being an insider in that world, and then suddenly becoming an outsider with this barrier of not only space, because of course the Atlantic was between us, but also this barrier of that comfortability of the mirror in front of your face for both of us. That constantly is reminding us that we're not just in conversation, that we are in an interview, that we are being recorded, that these words are going to come back to us at some point in time.
Yeah, it's definitely a good point. I'm just kind of conscious on the time, so I think I'll I don't know if this is going to be a softball or if it's going to be a difficult question, but just I'll hand it over to you. Past COVID, and let's get to the utopia of we're grand, we can go back to normal. But I am not going to use that term new normal because that drives me insane. But anyway, what do you look forward to doing? You know, once we are back to normal and in your oral history practice, what is the most sort of important thing and how do you see the future panning out? If you don't mind, I'd like to start with Pete, because you're kind of at that stage, you're on that cusp of moving forward.
Yeah, it'll definitely be a hybrid approach, I think, and the interview method will be dictated by the interviewee and what their preferences are. Because I've got a thing on the transcript, also the consent form even, that says, you know, we can either meet in person or remotely, and it's entirely up to you. There's no pressure either way. So I think depending on their preferences will dictate my interview tactics or style. But my preference, my utopia will be to go back to how it was in 2019. Where I could, you know, walk into a community centre or, you know, meet someone in a cafe, and or even go into someone's home and eat all the tea and biscuits they've got in the house, because I do miss it. And there's nothing quite like being in someone's house in their sort of comfort zone. I think it just brings a bit of richer testimony, and people sometimes, you know, retrieve pictures off bookshelves and, you know, old books that they got upstairs and magazines. As a prompt almost, and you know, it's just difficult to replicate some of this meta stuff over the internet. I think it makes a more richer experience for both parties being in person. But ultimately, that decision isn't going to be down to me. It's going to be down to the interviewer and what their preferences are.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that, Pete. I think that a hybrid approach, depending on what participants prefer and what is most tailored to their needs, is definitely the way forward. But if I'm allowed to sort of engage in my utopia for a second, I think my utopia would be a world where we've come through it. It's all in the past, but we're all so glad to be able to hang out with each other. That life is just one big constant oral history interview all the time, where we're all we're all going into each other's houses, we're all going into each other's community centres that have all been given all this funding from the government, or all our various governments, to stay open and warm and lit, and we can all have conversations in person all the time. That would be, that would be my dream.
Sounds wonderful. Rebecca, what do you think? What's your utopia, oral history utopia, should I say?
Yeah, yeah. Well, practically, there will be that hybrid approach. And I think I'll have hopefully a better chance with my Scotland side of the study and getting closer to that normal, closer to that in-person interview ability. But I just have a, maybe it's a pessimistic view, but unfortunately, because my second half of the study takes place in the American South and the Deep South, which is known for its hospitality and it's known for its warm welcome, there is a political atmosphere there that will prevent me being completely comfortable in in-person interviews, especially since there's no way for me to guarantee that anyone's being careful with the virus. So that'll put extra pressure on that side of the interview process for me, even though I do plan to travel back to the States to do a lot of that research and to work in the archives. There will be that extra pressure that wouldn't have been there pre-pandemic. So, and I don't see it disappearing. We have continual elections in the United States, and there's continual rhetoric that is happening surrounding COVID that is going to make things more difficult, I believe, for my study, just the, from the in-person perspective of the study. But yes, my utopia is that COVID never happened, and that, you know, in-person interviews are just a, an acceptable thing that don't come with caveats and don't come with risks that may not be acceptable. But I, unfortunately, I'm going to have to work in the reality that I'm given and not the reality that I want.
That is, yeah, that's the kind of unfortunate thing about it. COVID has been unleashed. We can't put it back in the box and file it away, I suppose. But it's definitely, I definitely think things have changed. And touching upon what you've said, this kind of idea of the hybrid approach, you know, it could be something that, although there, I recognise there are sort of downsides of not having that face-to-face, I think there's, we're kind of in a position now where we've had the explosion of Zoom, and you know, the sort of idea that even the older generations now are technologically savvy, that, you know, to a certain degree, that, you know, it might become, maybe oral history might change completely, and it's not just for the reasons that you were talking about, Rebecca, you know, about the whole idea that we're constantly thinking infection control and things like that. Maybe people just prefer to jump on their computer and in their house instead of sort of, you know, getting a taxi or a bus to wherever they're meeting somebody to interview. So I think it's going to be a very interesting time for us oral historians over the next number of years. And of course, sure, we're all the same. We're subject to funding, and we're all on a timer, and we're all kind of trying to get through as best we can in the time that we have as well. And yes, speaking of time, I think that we'll call an end to this discussion for today. So thanks so much, Amber, Pete, Rebecca. Thanks for joining me, and thanks everybody else as well for tuning in to us. And of course, tune into the next episode as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Simon. It's been great.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Really great question. Thank you.
Honestly, I kind of spoke like all day. Like, I think you can though, because there's so many different things, isn't there? Like, oral history stuff.